Good morning. This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first part of the program today, we will be talking about a little bit of food history and about how it is that over time people have thought about a very basic item, and that is bread. In the 19th century, there would have been a time when most people were eating bread that was homemade. And then within a relatively short period of time, there was a big change as people moved to bread that was an industrial product. We'll talk about how that happened and why in just a little bit. We do also want to take a moment here to remind you that listeners are the most important source of support, financial support, for this and all of the other programs that we have on this station. And now we're taking a little time to, first of all, to remind people of that, and then to say, well, if you're not a supporter, now would be a good time to do it. And you can call, you can go online. 244-9455 is the number, and willpledge.org is the website. And here in studio with me is the man that we like to call our producer emeritus of Focus. His name is Jack Brighton, and he was our producer for a long time, and now he's our webmaster.
So pleased to be with you, David.
It's
such a blast to be back on the show every once in a while. And I just want to say Focus is the awesomest show on public radio, and David Inge is the awesomest host, and he deserves your support. This show deserves your support. You keep it going with your pledge right now to 217-244-9455. You're in the driver's seat to keep this thing going. So don't forget that this is part of the community of listeners and the people in this community who depend upon all the great interviews that David Inge provides on Focus. So please give it your support with your dollars. And the number again, 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, over the past century, commercially baked white bread has been considered the height of modern progress, and it has also been considered to be a symbol of America's decline. How is it that one food could inspire so much love on the one hand and so much disdain on the other? Well, in this hour of Focus, we will talk about the social history of white bread. And the guest for our program is Aaron Bobrow Strain. He is Associate Professor of Politics at Whitman College. That's in Walla Walla, Washington. And he writes and teaches on the politics of the global food system. And he is the author of a very interesting book that is titled White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf, and it is published by the Beacon Press. It's out now if you'd like to take a look at it. If you're interested in history, you're interested in food, and how those two things come together, I think that you'll find it a very interesting book. And also, as we talk here, questions are welcome. As always, we like to get people into the conversation, so perhaps you have a question, you have a comment, you can dial us up and join in the conversation. 333-9455. In Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And Aaron, Barbara Strain, hello.
Good morning, David.
Hey, thanks very much
for
talking with me. Well, I think it's a very interesting subject, first of all, and it's just as an historical story, it's a great story, but also for the things that it tells us about how we think about food and the connections between food and politics. I think it's quite fascinating. And in fact, there are sort of two ways that you come at it. We could talk a little bit about that at first. That food and politics is one of them, but the other is as a bread baker.
That's right. I mean, I really got into this project because I'm a food historian, but I'm also a kind of a geeky amateur baker. Really like everything having to do with bread baking, and this was a great way for me to put those two things together, those two passions together.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk a lot, I'm sure, about food and politics. But generally speaking, when you think about bread, such an important staple item, maybe not quite as important today in our world as it has been in the past, but something that over a very long time has been really important to people. What do you find so interesting in looking at bread and what people's attitudes toward it have been?
Well, I mean, the first thing you have to start with is that is the material element, which is that for, you know, going back 4,000 years to the beginning of settled agriculture and the beginning of cities, pretty much everywhere from North Africa and the Middle East all the way up through Europe, across the steppes of Central Asia into northern India, people pretty much would have subsisted basically on bread alone, despite the biblical proverb people did subsist largely on bread. And this lasts well into the more recent period. In Europe, for example, although it would have varied by time and social class and location, we can kind of say in rough strokes, Europeans got between 50 to 60% of their daily calorie consumption from some form of bread from, let's say, the Middle Ages all the way up till as late as the 1950s.
Yeah.
And in the United States, even, this great agricultural food basket where we can grow anything, people got, on average, about 30% of daily calorie consumption from bread from the late 19th century all the way until the mid-1960s.
Yeah, that's bread and brewing are two things that have gone hand in hand going back a very long time, maybe two of the oldest kind of industries or mass-produced products probably you can think of.
They go hand in hand, absolutely. And in fact, if you look at, medieval English manors, a worker on one of those manors pretty much would have subsisted entirely on beer and bread.
Yeah. And
that's about it.
And it would have been considered to be such an important thing that, in fact, in a lot of places, that one of the things that people expected from their rulers, whoever they were, was to be provided with bread.
Right, so bread becomes immediately political. In fact, the very first class systems that emerge in the ancient Middle East are marked in part by what kind of bread you ate. More refined bread for the upper classes, more rocky, chaffy, rough bread for the lower classes. And it's interesting, the English word lord contains that history in its ancient roots. If you trace it back to its Old English roots, the word lord actually means bread giver or bread sharer, the person who was responsible for providing bread.
Hmm. Here in our town, we're lucky that we have a number of small independent bakeries that do what I think is fair to say is artisan bread. Each place is maybe a little bit different. You know, the style of bread is different. But the thing that I'm sure that many people appreciated about it is that it is a handmade product.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's interesting here, though, is if you look back, as I mentioned, I think back at the beginning here, there would have been a time when most people made their own bread. They made it at home, or they might have gone to a bakery that made bread. But it was indeed a handmade product. And that when the change came, the thing that people were worried about is the very thing that now we seem to value. What they were worried about was that it was a handmade product.
Right. So if we look, and this is something that just completely caught me by surprise. I didn't really have a sense of this when I started researching this question, which was that if we look at 1890, about 90% of all bread in America was baked in homes, mostly by women, of course, by hand, and only about 10% was from bakeries. And those bakeries were very small, typically urban, usually immigrant-run, relatively recent immigrants. But it changes very quickly, very dramatically, such that by 1930, it's completely reversed. 90% of bread is baked in factories by men and increasingly distant factories, and only 10% is baked in homes. And so it's this very dramatic change in a product that, as I just mentioned, is so fundamental to people's subsistence and also as a result to their cultural life and their identity. It's a very dramatic change. And it required all kinds of technological and scientific accomplishments to do that. Because bread is anyone who's baked bread by hand knows this. Bread mm-hmm. is a living biological thing. It changes with temperature. It's made by microbes that grow and live and die. And so that turns out to be really hard to figure out a way to shoehorn that into the capitalist industrial assembly line that requires a steady, fast pace of production, not the kind of unruly rhythms of biology. So it requires all this science and chemistry to essentially tame the unruly dough to the assembly line.
Yeah.
And that happens in the 1900s, 1910s. And it turns out to be actually the easy part is the technological piece. Then the hard part is how do you convince people to make this shift in the food that they depend on more than any other single food for their sustenance? How do you get them to make such a dramatic shift? And what I found is that there are two factors at play there in terms of getting essentially two big gifts for people who are starting up industrial bakeries and learning how to make bread in massive quantities. One bakery in 1925 churned out 1 million loaves in a day. So massive quantities of bread that they then had to sell somehow. And there were two things that really helped them. And the first one was, it turns out, a kind of lurking racial fear. We can say that from 1880 to about 1920, middle-class, native-born America goes through this kind of moral panic about the cleanliness of its bread. Newspaper headlines read, you know, dangerous bakeries menace the city, germs lurk in your bread. There's this fear about contagion and bread, and even bread baked at home by mothers was considered by many experts to be a potential biohazard. Mothers weren't trustworthy from a scientific expert perspective. And I was reading all this, and this is very strange for me to read, because at the same time I could find no evidence that bread was actually making anyone sick. So what's going on here? And what I found reading through all the testimonies and reports on the bread problem is that food fears about unclean bread had become inseparable from racial fears about the supposedly scary, supposedly dirty new immigrants whose hands were touching that bread as they sweated away in small bakeries. And also, I should add, kind of gendered fears about usually lower-class mothers, that mothers were irresponsible and couldn't follow scientific advice about diet and child-rearing, and thus were putting the nation's health in danger, in jeopardy. So in that context, beautiful white shining loaves churned out by these gleaming white factories with stainless steel and white surfaces that were advertised as bread untouched by human hands, they kind of created this kind of reassuring sense of safety for consumers. So this idea of a lot of middle-class consumers in the 1920s were wanting to know, where does my bread come from? Where is my bread made? Similar to what you hear a lot today. But what they were worried about was that they didn't want their bread made by dirty, scary immigrants. And that kind of wanting to know where your bread came from mixed up with the racial fear turns out to be a great gift for industrial bakers.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of focus is Aaron Bobrow Strain. He is Associate Professor of Politics at Whitman College, that's in Washington State, and he's interested in the politics of the global food system. And if you want to read more on this particular subject, that is the subject of his book, White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf, and it's published by the Beacon Press out of Boston. We have a couple of callers here to welcome into the conversation. Let's do that. We'll start with someone in Savoy on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I have a small one and a larger question. Let's do the tiny one first. These people who were exclaiming about the infectious quality and the unclean nature of these various sources of the bread, were these professors or were these just so-called journalists raking muck, or what were they?
Well, you know, it was this moment in American history, the progressive era, where there was an upswelling of concern about the safety and quality of food across the board. In many ways, it's similar to today's movement, where we have a lot of concern about organics and local agriculture and issues like that. So it was really a combination of lots of different types of people, certainly muckraking journalists, Certainly, the new field of home economics. So you had a lot of kind of middle class women who were becoming professionalized through home economics. You even had a field called scientific motherhood or scientific parenting that tried to apply scientific laws to the art of raising children. So it was really a broad sweeping movement of people, mostly middle class, mostly native-born white. And it kind of comes together in what historians call the pure food movement. And I think this is ultimately one of the big points of my book, is that these movements that come up at various times around food safety are always a little bit ambiguous. Because on one hand, the pure food movement, as I'm just describing, plays off of these racial fears and inflames these racial fears, demonizes lower class mothers for not following expert advice. But at the same time, the pure food movement is also responsible for laying the foundation across the nation for food safety legislation. And some of the most important food safety protections that we have today are a legacy of that pure food movement. So when we talk about food reform movements like this, we have to look at both the positive things that they create, but also the unintended negative consequences of them.
Well, do you know how many years passed between what you've just described and the passage of the FDA laws?
You're referring to the Pure Food, Drug, and Drink Act of 1906, is that?
Well, I'm sorry, I can't remember the names now. Yeah. I just recall it. We use it so much in my field that we just say FDA, and it is Drug and Act, and F is federal and that, but I don't know the full name of the legislation. So I was just wondering how many years lapsed between
That is a direct result of this movement, the Pure Foods movement. Mm-hmm. It's one of their great accomplishments. It's the 1906 Pure Food and Drug Law. However, you know, they were also involved at local levels, at state levels. In places like Chicago, women's groups got laws passed about bakery cleanliness. They boycotted bakeries that they felt were unsafe. There was a lot of activity going on.
Well, thank you. My more historical question that ranges longer is somewhere I came across some information that there were bakeries, I guess that's what you would call them, but at least one of the major components of that place would be to just provide a lot of oven space, and there would be women from the neighborhood that would bring in their dough, and they would go there and bake that. Did you come across anything about that in your studies?
You know, that's absolutely the way that, especially in, for example, many parts of rural Europe, that would have been the norm. And certainly, I came across stories of that from 19th century Missouri, you know, the American heartland out where you guys, I imagine that there were probably towns with you know, German immigrants where you would have found something like that. But really, I'm focusing on the more modern period, this moment of the creation of the fluffy industrial white loaf, and how that comes about. So I don't spend as much time talking about the old traditional bread ways.
Okay. I want to thank the caller. We have somebody who is also waiting from Chicago that we'll get to in a moment here. We'll continue to talk with Aaron Bobro Strain about the history of the factory-made white sliced loaf of bread. I also want to take a minute here to, again, to encourage people to support the station. We're in an effort here this spring to encourage people to call in and make contributions. We've been here since last Thursday, and this is, for us in this month, going to be the last day to do this, and it will be the last couple of opportunities we'll have here on Focus to ask for your support. So if you've been listening to us now talk about this for several days and you have thought, well, you know, I'm going to do that, maybe now would be a good time to do it. It will really help us, and I think that you'll feel good about it. We like to think so. Jack Brighton is here in the studio with me. He's the guy who is now in charge of our web operations for a long time. He was the producer for this program.
Yeah, I sure enjoyed that. I tell you, radio is so wonderful. It's really about community, and this show is about community, and everybody who listens to this show is part of that, and you're part of supporting it, too. So don't forget that you have a role in supporting the efforts of David and Celeste and Harriet Williamson, the producer of the show, the current producer of the show, they're all part of this community that you also are a huge part of. And your duty right now is to keep it going with just a simple voice of support for Focus 580 and for WILL. 217-244-9455. That is our pledge line. We want you to call it now and become a part of the community of the Friends of WILL.
Yeah, it's important for people to remember, and we do try to remind them of this from time to time, that more than 40% of the budget for the station comes from the audience. And right now we're raising the money that will pay for next year's programming. Our fiscal year ends on June 30th, and we want to be on track to make sure we have enough money for next year's programming. And so to that end, we have set a goal for the month of April of $250,000 in member support. And that's a big, that's a lot of money, obviously. But if we can get the response of even a fraction of the people who are listening, then we would have no trouble meeting that goal. So what we want to do is we just like to get in as many folks as possible. If maybe you've been listening for a while and you have not made a contribution before, that's great. You know, for whatever reason, we're great you listen, but we hope that you would also be a contributor, because the money that you give us, that's the energy source for the station. That's what makes it possible for us to do what we do.
That's right. And it is a sustainable energy source. It is actually a better way of supporting community broadcasting, public broadcasting, than, for example, selling advertisements, because then our whole mission would shift, right? So just think like a dollar a week, $52 a year. Your contribution of $52 makes a huge difference. So right now, we're asking you to make that contribution. 217-244-9455. Or you can go online to willpledge.org.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us, and also glad to have as our guest this morning Aaron Bobrow Strain. He's associate professor of politics at Whitman College in Washington, and he is the author of the book White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf. It is published by the Beacon Press. And questions, again, are welcome. We had some people here. My apologies. Maybe I keep them waiting too long. We'll try to get you in if you want to give us a call. You can also go online and send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu, or you can call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. What I think is really quite interesting here, if you look at the way people have thought about bread just over the last century or so, you will see a cycle. And you talked about the fact that, so in the late 19th century, most people were eating bread that was homemade. And then there is the shift to the factory product, because people were persuaded that it was modern, it was clean, that it was the best thing that they could do for their family to buy that, and rather than make it themselves. Yeah. So then, interestingly enough, you know, now we think about people who are preaching the importance of having whole grain in your diet and eating healthy and so forth. In reaction to white bread, This this was certainly before World War II, there were people who made that same argument. They said white bread was evil. It was poisonous. It was a terrible thing to give that to your children. And they were then preaching eating whole grains.
Right. Almost as soon as industrial white bread gets taken up in a en masse throughout the United States as this shining icon of modernity and progress. In fact, it was actually one of the things I discovered is that bakery engineers of the early 20th century, they literally designed and re-engineered bread. They smoothed it out. They made it sleek. They squared off the corners in order to make the bread look like a sleek, streamlined piece of modern art, like the Zephyr train of food, really.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this shining icon of modernity. And so, of course, immediately you have people who start lining up to critique that. And they blame industrial white bread for causing everything from tuberculosis to criminal insanity. What's interesting is that these folks, these anti-white bread crusaders who emerge in the 1920s, first of all, they're very much, in many ways, one of the direct forebears of today's organic locavore health movement. In fact, Michael Pollan talks about the slogan, the whiter your bread, the quicker you're dead, and he attributes it to the 1960s counterculture, which is true, but actually the 1960s counterculture got it from a 1920s Chicago radio health advisor named Dr. Clark, who used to broadcast in Chicago in the 20s. There's this massive reaction against white bread, also wrapped up in larger social anxieties, questions about, you know, what do we really think about this promise of industrial utopia, right? If the shining white piece of sliced white bread is a edible piece of a promise of an industrial utopia to come, when hunger and scarcity and want have all been conquered by technology, do we really buy into that? There's a lot of doubts that come up in the 1920s about that. And also racial anxieties as well. This was the high point of eugenics in the United States, the racial eugenics movement. And a lot of those anti-white bread crusaders were very much worried that white Americans eating a diet of industrial fluffy white bread would become weak and would lose ground to threatening dark races from abroad. So very much they wanted people to eat whole grain foods in order to have fit white bodies, a kind of fit, pure, vigorous society was the language they used.
Yeah.
So it's. I think there's the old Wonder Bread jingle that Wonder Bread is just a slice of America, and I think what I learned is that actually fighting over white bread is also a perennial fixture of American life.
All right, let's talk with somebody else in Chicago on our toll free line number 4. Hello.
Yeah. Hi, David. Thanks.
Sure.
Interesting program. I'm enjoying the historical. Perspective, kind of a coming together of the age of advertising, migration to the cities, and then I remember Teddy Roosevelt finding out about the slaughterhouses in Chicago and how sausage is actually made. So very, very interesting. I'm in my mid-50s and I grew up in Chicago and have very fond memories of my aunt making bread from scratch without a recipe almost on a daily basis. And I just remember cutting off huge thick slices of that glass of milk and butter, and I could see how your guest says you could basically survive off of that. And what I also noticed was the homemade bread lasted very long as far as not going stale. And this bread now, this white bread now, is almost completely devoid of taste. There's no texture to it at all. And, man, if you don't get that covered up soon, that thing goes bad really quickly. And I guess my biggest sadness is just the kids today, the changing in our culture, not realizing what they've missed by all those homemade products. So anyway, listening, I'll offer that up for a comment. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
That's a great memory. And what I found was that actually Americans have been saying things like that really for the past 100 years. I found examples from the 1900s of people lamenting how we just don't have bread anymore the way mother used to make it. So there's something perennial about that. This kind of feeling that somehow our society we're losing something, which is interesting because at that time mother was still very much making the bread.
Yeah.
So what was that anxiety about when people were nostalgically saying, "Boy, I sure miss the days when mother made bread."
Yeah. Well, and you were just talking, before we took the caller, you were talking a little bit about how there was this sort of the first go-round of the whole food movement when people were attacking white bread, both in a literal way, saying that it was not a good thing nutritionally, but also sort of symbolically for what it represented, much the way I think people in the 60s talked about, you know, use the phrase white bread. What's though interesting, though, is that the bread companies, the big commercial manufacturers, they fought back and they did things like enrich the bread and they put vitamins in there. And, you know, that's where we get into the age of the Wonder Bread building strong bodies 12 ways. They were trying to really pitch the product as a healthy thing in response to those people who said that it wasn't.
Yes, by the 1930s, big industrial bakers of fluffy white industrial bread were under siege in many ways. The anti-white bread crusaders were gaining quite a bit of ground, winning the hearts and minds of people and convincing people that the nation's staple was not particularly vital. There was kind of this death struggle between the idea of white bread as this strong, vigorous symbol of the nation and responsibility and upper class living, and this idea of white bread as sapping the strength and vigor of the nation. And what really saves Wonder Bread or white bread from itself, as you alluded to, is vitamin enrichment, mm-hmm. Using synthetic vitamins to add back the vitamins that are taken out during refining of flour, and then some to add a little bit more, and that really comes about as a result of World War II, because as World War II or U.S. involvement in World War II is starting to loom in the late 30s, war planners start to look around at the state of the country and they get very worried because. I know today we have, all these kind of nice books that kind of romanticize the frugality and the real ingredients of Depression-era cooks, and that's fine and great. But actually, the nutritional status of Americans during the Great Depression was a nightmare. We had people dying from malnutrition in large numbers. It was bad. And planners were worried that how is this nation going to fight? And in fact, when they do their first round of selective service call-up in 1941, they have to reject almost half of the first million men called up for selective service, and a lot of those rejections have at their root cause various forms of malnutrition and vitamin deficiency. So these war planners are worried. They're looking around, and they latch onto white bread as both the cause and the solution to their problem. It's the cause because they're really worried that a nation of fluffy white bread eaters is just going to fold in the face of Germans who are eating hearty dark bread. The solution, because they realize that if they turn white bread into a vitamin delivery mechanism, they can get nutrition out to 95% of households two or three times a day. It's a really interesting moment, too, for me as someone who thinks about food in the present, because a number of baking companies, the big baking companies at the time, they wanted to go this route. They wanted to make vitamin-enriched bread an expensive, premium-priced commodity that only the wealthy could afford, with the idea that the wealthy would start to buy that, and eventually that would create more and more demand, and then it would trickle down and poor people would be able to buy it eventually, kind of like we've gone with the organic route. But the U.S. government said no. In fact, this is urgent, and we need vitamins to get out to everyone, so let's enrich. They mandated mandatory enrichment of all white bread. It's actually a very democratic moment in the American food system. As much as today we might look back and say, oh, well, why didn't they go with fresh fruits and vegetables or whole grain breads or something like that? Yeah, I can understand that. But it's a really interesting democratic moment.
Yeah. Well, we're talking again in this hour of focus with Aaron Bobrow-Strain. We're talking about some of what you will find in his book, White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon with 10 different topics for you every week. In the second hour today, we will be talking with Bruce Hannon. He is an emeritus professor of geography at the U of I. We'll be talking about, though, not geography, but something that has been a hobby and a love of his for a long time, and that is the repair and maintenance of mechanical clocks. He has done some work on a number of interesting and historical clocks on the U of I campus, and we'll talk a little bit about how he got into that and about some of the clocks that he has worked on, including the one that is in the courthouse, the Champaign County Courthouse, in the big tower downtown in Urbana. Then tomorrow morning, our guest is Amy Redding. She's a writer, and we'll be talking about her book, The Mark Inside, A Perfect Swindle, A Cunning Revenge, and A Small History of the Big Con. And it takes a look at a history of cons in U.S., but in particular, one that involved a Texas rancher who in 1919 was the victim of a con, and he did something that was very rare. He decided to get even, and he did. It's a great story. So that's tomorrow. We're here again, as I say, weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. You can check the schedule by going to the website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. Now, something else we hope that you will do is to, well, you can go to the website, in fact, and make a pledge that way if you'd like. There's a place there to pledge, so you can do it online at willpledge.org. You can call us at 244-9455. However you do it, whichever way, we hope that you'll take the opportunity to support the station.
It's really important that you step up right now in support of WILL and Focus, because really, we have 13,000 people who support this station. It may seem like, well, one more call isn't going to make a big difference. My contribution doesn't really matter, because you've got 13,000 people supporting this station. We know that a lot more than 13,000 people listen to this station. And if more of them contributed, really, we would have an opportunity to just do a lot more than we already are doing. So, and just keeping this thing going is important. So your call, one call at a time, gets us to 13,000. That's kind of how it happens. So you can step up to the plate right now and make your pledge, 217-244-9455, or online at willpledge.org.
And you can think about the amount. We sometimes suggest, well, maybe $52. That would be a dollar a week. Some people might even be able to do, who knows, a dollar a day, or you can pick something in between those two numbers. That's the part for you to decide once you have made the decision that you are going to be a supporter of the station. And we have some folks who have been supporters for a very long time, and they're wonderful folks, and I always appreciate meeting people and say, yes, they've been listening and have been supporting the station for a long time, and we thank them. But we can't; they can't continue to do the job by themselves. What we really want to do is, over time here, grow that base of support, because really it is the only kind of support we can expect is going to grow over time. So that's one of the reasons that we actually ask. We sit down here in front of the microphones and we ask for support to try to bring folks like that into the group we call the Friends of WILL.
And think about a dollar a week. That's less than a loaf of white bread. I mean, really. And it's better for you. Focus is better for you than white bread. So think about that and how much you spend on, you know, trivial things like a cup of coffee. That's kind of what we're asking here. If you just give us a call right now, that would be deeply appreciated. 217-244-9455.
Believe me, there's nothing trivial about coffee. But that's a subject for another show.
Okay, we'll take that up later. Thank you.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Aaron Bobrow Strain. He is Associate Professor of Politics at Whitman College. That is in Walla Walla, Washington. He writes and teaches on the politics of the global food system, and we are talking about some of what you will find in his book, White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf, and it is published by the Beacon Press. And, of course, questions are welcome as we continue here to talk. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk at illinois.edu. We talked about this cycle from homemade bread to the factory product, and then people criticizing the factory product, and the bread industry coming back and making this argument that, no, this is a really good thing. It's good for you. And then we come to the 60s, where we come back again to people saying a lot of the same things about diet and health. And when here, in both literally and symbolically, the idea of white bread is it's an artificial industrial plastic kind of a product, that it's empty, and what you really want is the real thing. So people come around again back to talking about whole grains and organic foods, and again it's a reaction against the white bread.
That's right, and it kind of gets taken up as the symbol of everything that the counterculture opposed, right? It's plastic, it's corporate, it's chemical, it's suburban, and so you see it getting taken up as this kind of symbol of what we're trying to undo. It becomes a food dream, but it's also a dream about a different kind of society, right? It's a dream about coming together and changing the world through food choices, and that has a huge influence on how people eat. But what's interesting is that in the earlier period, when the 1920s food gurus were attacking white bread, the industry fought back tooth and nail. They came up with this idea of enrichment to help restore the idea that white bread was vigorous and strong and associated it with patriotism and fighting wars and strength. So this is a strong reaction. But in the 1960s and 1970s, the industrial bread baking industry takes a different tack, which is they say, you know, we can go with this. And we're just going to take this whole wheat bread rebellion and turn it into our newest niche market for making lots and lots of money. And in fact, that's what they do. So by the 1970s, we see that kind of rebellious spirit of the 60s that surrounds whole grain breads really gets wrapped up into a consumer-driven health food kind of individual self-actualization movement. So that by the beginning of the Reagan years, all the rebelliousness and dreams of social change are gone, and whole wheat bread and other kinds of handmade breads have basically gotten folded into a kind of elite consumer-driven niche market model.
And that's, I think, what's another part of the story that's really interesting is that when you look at the what the counterculture folks of the 60s were thinking when they were preaching this change in the way that people thought about food and the way that they ate, they thought that would be getting people to change that would open the door to much bigger kind of change. You know, they seem to think that food was the thin edge of the wedge, and that if you could get people to do that, then you could do anything. And it's interesting that in fact that didn't turn out to be the door opening that they thought. And as you say, it became much more something about individual personal transformation rather than social transformation.
Right. It gets individualized and turned into a consumer thing instead of a collective vision of change. But, you know, they weren't alone in that. In many ways, my book is a book about bread, but because bread is our most, because industrial fluffy white bread is our most fought over food over the past 100 years, my book also really became a book about all the different social movements and food gurus and health experts and social reformers who felt like if we can just get Americans to eat the right bread, actually usually to stop eating the wrong bread, it will fix bigger social problems, right? Like you said, it's the wedge that if we could just get people to change their food choices, other things will fall into place, right? And in the early 20th century, it was fears about the racial makeup of the nation, fears about class and, you know, what are women's roles in society. And I think what I find is that as with the 60s, changing or trying to change people's food habits does affect society. It does create radical different social kinds of changes, but not usually the social changes that the reformers wanted.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I talked a little bit earlier about how here in our town, we're lucky we have some very nice small independent bakeries. And I was thinking about this last night as I was sitting down to dinner and having a very nice seeded baguette that came from one of these places. And I was thinking about also, not only was it such a nice thing to have, but I was thinking that I was lucky that I could afford to pay the $3.25 that cost. And that here again, we, you know, bread becomes a political issue, becomes an economic issue, it becomes some kind of a social signifier because not everybody can. And so that there are some people who are, you know, they're going down to the grocery store and they're buying the least expensive bread that they can because that's what they can afford and they have a family to feed. And so that gets us into all sorts of issues about politics, class, and economics once again.
Right. And I come into this as someone who, as I said, I'm an artisan bread baker, and I'm actually one of those very stereotypical backyard chicken raising, farmers market shopping, cheese making. I really like to pickle things.
I know a few people like that. That's
okay. I'm sure you do, right? And I worked on a ranch, and I really come out of it with, I've been involved in efforts to change the food system for 20 years. And I really do believe that, you know, the environmental and health and social costs of our industrial food system are way too high. So I come at it in a sympathetic way. But really what this becomes is a book about, it comes out of this, right? I'm looking around as I'm starting to think about a book to write, and I'm looking around with that attitude of how do we change the food system, and I see that we're living in this era where we've had an explosion of great books about, Michael Pollan's and Eric Schlosser's and Marion Nestle's and people like that who are telling us how much is wrong with our food. Right? I don't think we actually lack information about where our food comes from and what's wrong with it. But as I looked around, what really struck me is that there are really no books out there. There was nothing out there about how people have tried to change the food system in the past, what traps they fell into, where they succeeded, where they failed, where they achieved a kind of democratic change, where they just reinforced social hierarchies and elitism. And white bread became this really fun way to get at those serious questions about the both the benefits but also the dangers and risks of trying to change the world through food choices.
Well, it also makes me think about here, we're at this time when there's a lot of concern about public health, particularly about people's weight.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no shortage of advice on what people should be doing. I think we all know what we should be doing. And at the same time, people aren't doing what they should be. So there are a lot of questions about, well, what sort of choices do people make? What constraints are there on their choices? Why people make the choices they do? And it still seems that we're wrestling with this idea that, you know, if you're not healthy, well, this is a moral failure on your part. And it's because somehow you know what's good for you, but you just don't do it.
That's absolutely right. And there's my favorite story, the story that really got me thinking about this is the story of Sylvester Graham. He was a food reformer, a very influential food reformer from the 1830s, 1840s, kind of one of the Michael Pollans of the mid-19th century, if you will. He's an interesting character. He's really probably the person who does the most to get Americans thinking that eating whole grain bread is both healthy and morally virtuous. Some people consider him the father of vegetarianism in the United States. He also had some really interesting early ideas about the importance of local food, local agriculture. So he's a really intriguing character. Also, the Graham cracker is named after him. But what really interests me is how he first got launched into prominence as a kind of celebrity food guru. And it's in the 1830s. He goes to New York during the height of a cholera epidemic that's sweeping up and down the East Coast. And he gives this series of speeches about why the poor are getting cholera. And these speeches are wildly enthusiastically embraced by kind of the elites of the East Coast. And basically what he says in a kind of broad strokes in a nutshell, what he says in these speeches is that the poor are getting cholera because they don't have the moral backbone to make the right choices about food. They're eating too much white bread, eating too much meat, drinking too much alcohol, and therefore are getting cholera, and therefore are endangering all of the rest of us who are moral people and can make the right choices about food. And so he had this very simple solution, right? That we give the poor moral backbone by giving them more dietary fiber. So, you know, he said more whole wheat, more local vegetables, more pure water. I find nothing wrong with his food recommendations, right, especially at a time when the American diet was pretty much white bread, maybe some meat, then some white bread, maybe some very, very boiled vegetables, then more white bread, right? His dietary recommendations aren't so bad. But what happens is that he's so fixated on the idea that these social problems are caused by people's failure to make the right choices about food, and that the solution to these social problems are kind of empowering people to make different choices about food, that he completely misses the real reason why people in New York were getting cholera. They were getting cholera, the poor in New York were getting cholera because of brutal conditions and low wages in sweatshops, a corrupt city government that couldn't provide sanitation, and profiteering by private vendors of pure water. So basically he takes something that's really about the market and government and turns it into a kind of simple and easy to approach thing about people's food choices, right? And as when I first read that story, I was speechless because I realized if you were to substitute cholera and obesity, you know, we're pretty much talking about obesity in the same way he was. And I think we're missing root causes of obesity in the same way and thinking about food choices as being the cause of obesity when really they're a symptom of an underlying social problem that we need to deal with. As a food reformer, I think that in 50 years we'll look back at our obesity epidemic and realize that we didn't have a problem with people making the wrong choices about food. We had a problem with stagnated real wages, wages that on average for most Americans have not increased since the 1970s in inflation-adjusted terms, growing inequality, and high levels of concentration and deregulation in the industrial food system. That's, I think, what is at the heart of our problem with obesity. So we should stop harping on people with larger bodies and try to focus more on the root causes.
We'll have to stop. It's a good story. There is more in the book. People can read White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf, published by the Beacon Press, by our guest, Aaron Bobrow-Strain. He's Associate Professor of Politics at Whitman College in Washington. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks, David.